All right, everybody. It's the one. I'm Greg Gutfeld. I got a really interesting writer coming up. He wrote a really unusual book. His name is Daniel Calder, and the book is called The Infernal Library. It's basically a tour of dictator literature. So it's basically books written by the world's worst people, men who've killed millions and millions of innocent people. And I don't think a book like this has ever been done before. I know Daniel because I read his first book called Lost Cosmonaut, which is a really strange travelogue about weird places in Russia and weird people. And it was just such an odd thing. And the weird thing about Daniel is that he's kind of an expert on Russia, and he's Scottish, but he lives in Texas. And Daniel, how are you?
I'm doing all right, thank you.
Good. So your book, your latest book, you have such odd topics. You decided to write a book, which is basically a catalog of dictator literature. How did you come to this idea? Why did you do it?
Yeah, maybe somebody should restrain me before I go down these paths. So I used to, basically, I lived in Russia for about 10 years, and I was aware that dictators had written a lot of books, but I kind of assumed it was like a dead tradition.
Yeah.
But then, kind of early 2000s, there was this crazy dictator in Turkmenistan in Central Asia called Turkmenbashi, and he had this wild personality cult that was North Korean levels of madness. So there were statues everywhere and all kinds of stuff. And he published a book, and I saw this on Russian TV. And it was called the Ruhnama, the Book of the Soul, and people were holding it almost like it was the Bible or some holy text. And so
right.
So that was really interesting. And then around the same time, I discovered Saddam Hussein had written a romance novel called The Beaver and the King. And so here were kind of two fairly wild dictators kind of still writing books.
Yeah.
So I kind of traveled in Turkmenistan, and then I started digging around, started reading some of these old books like The Little Red Book or Mein Kampf or things by Stalin. And then I realized there was like basically just a century's worth of books by dictators that people were, like as soon as the regimes fall, people stopped reading them. And so they were being forgotten. And I thought, well, that's kind of really strange because they're very significant books. They had a big impact. And maybe it's not right that we should forget them. Maybe somebody should go take a look at them.
Right.
So I decided to do that, and then I didn't realize it would take me 8 years at the time.
Was it hard to find some of these books? And I got to ask you also about the romance novel before I forget, because I don't know if you read a lot of romance novels. Did it feel like a typical romance novel, or was it something? Was there a twist to it?
In the romance novel, it was not a typical romance novel, as you might expect, coming from The Butcher of Baghdad.
Yeah.
It was a sort of historical romance between a kind of ancient Iraq. There was this pagan king and a beautiful young Muslim woman, and he's all isolated from the people, and he meets her, he falls in love.
Right.
And then she kind of travels to his palace in the middle of the night, and all they do is discuss politics and leadership. And then eventually, though, he does fall in love, and it becomes quite interesting, because then it's like Saddam Hussein is talking about the loneliness of the king and how he feels isolated, and there's like very weird passages on rape and sort of intercourse between men and bears, which are very, very strange.
That is strange. That's why I figured it wasn't going to be a typical romance novel.
No.
When you introduce bestiality into it. Do you think that since when you become dead, and your books immediately become hits because you're dead, did his death have any impact on the sales of his romance novel?
I think it probably had a negative effect because he couldn't force anybody to read it anymore.
That's true.
So for him, although I think, interest outside of Iraq probably continued, And then you also asked in terms of finding them, is it difficult? And so some of them, yes. So, the interesting thing about communist dictators like Lenin or Stalin is they believed they had access to a universal truth. So they actually translated practically everything they did into multiple languages and distributed it around the world. So, you can pick up Like I was like in a bookshop in Scotland, and just a little bookshop in St Andrews where they play a lot of golf, and I found a pamphlet by Stalin about combine harvesters and how excellent combine harvesters were. So this had made its way from Moscow all the way to this little town because they were so, they had this messianic belief
right.
in what they were talking about. Other ones were pretty difficult. I joined a research library, and I think, you know, I was getting books by Bulgarian dictators, and I think I was like the first person in 40 years to check them out.
Yeah.
And then Mussolini wrote this play about Napoleon that I had to import from some moldy copy from Ireland. So that was quite interesting too, was tracking them down.
So let me ask you this, because it's, is there any inclination, hint, not inclination, terrible word, is there any hint in these books, like the, prior to them becoming dictators, that they would be dictators? Is there any kind of dictator type rhetoric, or I mean, it's like, are they obvious about their desires and need for power?
So let's say like Hitler or Mussolini, it's really obvious,
right?
I mean, they're just really in your face.
Yeah,
I mean Hitler's. Doesn't hide the fact that he's a foaming racist who desires to sort of run the world. And,
yeah.
and Mussolini talks a lot about sacred violence and he is the leader and da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. So with those guys, it's really clear. With the communists like Lenin or Stalin, they wrote in a much more restrained, incredibly boring theoretical style.
Right.
So their books aren't manic declarations of... intention, you have to kind of read between the lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clear that they think, yes, the Bolshevik Party or the communists should run the world. The world should have a revolution. The communists should be in charge. This is clear from the start.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't kind of talk about themselves in the same way, and I will be the supreme leader.
Right.
That kind of follows on from mm-hmm. what they're talking about, but it's not explicit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you take on such weird topics, because the topics that you often take on require a lot from you because they are boring in the sense that you have to slog through these texts, which are boring. And it was kind of like when you did The Lost Cosmonauts. There's a lot of really tedious things that you went and experienced. And how did you get – I mean, did you just drink a lot of coffee?
Yeah. Well, for this book – yeah, you know, I mean, I grew up in a very, very small town in Scotland, Greg,
mm-hmm.
and there was not a lot to do. And I think I acquired a high tolerance for boredom. Maybe even I got quite interested in it.
Yes.
What is boredom as a phenomenon?
Mm-hmm.
And then that was maybe what interested me to these books, is because they're extremely boring and people were forced to read them
exactly.
for years. And I thought, well, what happens to that experience? You know, that experience disappears, but mm-hmm. it was real, you know. And I knew a lot of people in Russia, and they only talked about these kind of books in terms of extreme boredom.
Yeah.
So, you know, boredom's a very widely found element on the human planet, on our planet. And so it does interest me. And in terms of how I got through it, yeah, it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard. And so, I did kind of tricks. I played tricks on myself, so... Like Chairman Mao, I would try reading them in different places.
Right.
So I remember reading Mussolini. It was getting a bit boring. So I thought, all right, I'll go have catfish in a kind of country restaurant in Texas, and I'll read Mussolini over catfish, see how that works out. And that sort of transplanting myself made it momentarily fresh. I remember I had this big volume of Stalin, and I thought, I'll go read this in a hipster cafe in downtown Austin. So at lunch, I would go and read Stalin in this hipster cafe. And Chairman Mao, I would read his military writings in McDonald's, for example. So it was like just over time and changing things. And then also with Mao, he was so boring. I tried reading him in a fever to see if he was any more interesting. I was kind of half hallucinating. And it didn't make him more interesting. And then I had to read it again once I felt better because I couldn't remember anything. Mostly it was just forcing myself to get through them.
That's so funny because it is like I always have to reread stuff that I've read when I had it when I drank. Like, if I'm drinking and I go, you know what, I had a few drinks, I'm going to open up a book and I'm reading it and I'm underlining and writing stuff the next day, I have to, like, reread it and I can't understand anything that I've actually written in the margins. But I'm going to take your advice on this because, like, picking a location to read a book is I never really thought about it before, and I think that's kind of interesting, especially if you know, if there's a book you don't want to read or you know it's going to be a slog, it's probably good to have some kind of stimulus around you, maybe. I don't know.
And it kind of changes the experience. Maybe you can kind of create a contradiction.
Yeah.
Which Chairman Mao would have approved of.
Yeah.
Or or conduct a social experiment. You know, if I read Stalin in a hipster kind of cafe, will anybody, you know, punch me in the face?
And mm-hmm.
the answer is no.
Nobody
cares.
No. You know the.
What's that?
What I was asking is, like, if okay, let's take young men have grand ideas about themselves, and let's say they, and a lot of men who have grand ideas begin their lives as writers. I would say that I thought that I had incredible ideas, but I was hopelessly naive and you know, stupid about politics. I think, you know, I was a liberal, but I had big ideas. You know, but the thing is, I became a writer and I became became pretty successful at it. What I'm getting at is, do you have to first just be a failure as a writer to become a dictator? Like, no, none of these guys were really successful until they became a dictator, right? Kind of.
Yeah, except for Mussolini. I think he was like a really successful journalist.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, he left the Socialist Party. Mm-hmm. So he was a successful socialist journalist, and then he left. And then, like, at one point, he was so unsuccessful that his former allies walked under his window with a coffin, and it symbolized his death.
Mm.
You know, the death of him as a kind of successful force. So I think, I think these guys, a lot of them were writers first.
Yeah.
And they had monumental arrogance,
mm-hmm.
You know, and they were writing not just about, you know, sensitive memoir.
Yeah.
They were writing, you know, grandiose plans for how to run the world.
Right.
And nobody listened to them, you know, in most cases for long periods. So it probably does. I guess in that case, you're either going to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to become really annoyed.
Yes.
And double down on it.
Yeah.
And
it's like I think, like, damn it, if Stalin had a bestseller or Hitler had a bestseller, it could have changed. They wouldn't have gone to where they've gone. But that's an alternative. What do you call that? Alternative history.
Alternative reality. Well, yeah. Stalin's an interesting case because he when he was a teenager, he wrote poetry,
mm-hmm.
and the poetry was successful. I mean, he published the poetry in a very prestigious literary journal. He was 15 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
And maybe he had a choice, right? I will continue writing poetry, and drink wine, mm-hmm. and wear a shirt with ruffs on it. Or I'll become a murderous revolutionary, and unfortunately, he chose the latter.
Yeah.
But you know, there are one or two instances where some of these guys were at that kind of threshold, and then chose the dark path.
Why do you think dictators and murderous tyrants in general are attractive to people who should know better? I mean, I think about certain celebrities, and even going back to, you know, to there are writers that. Supported Hitler. There are celebrities that defended Hugo Chavez, that defend Venezuela now. There are Castro, people that love Castro. They're all either, you know, some of them are artists or writers. What is it that – look at Sean, like somebody like Sean Penn, who was a big Hugo Chavez fan. What is it about – how does this happen?
It's a phenomenon that goes all the way back.
Yeah.
So, you know, George Bernard Shaw, went to – Soviet Union, well, there's a famine in the Ukraine, and said, I've never eaten so well in my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Churchill and Gandhi said nice things about Mussolini. And then, of course, you know, as you say, Chavez had all kinds of fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, part of it, I think, is willful ignorance.
Yeah.
Willful ignorance. I think there's a desire, maybe they look around and they're dissatisfied with things in their own society. And then they sort of look around for some alternative. And you know, and life is very complicated and very, and it's hard. Running a country is hard. But I think, you know, simplifications have a great appeal.
Yeah.
And so, like, a lot of the appeal of these dictators before they become dictators is they offer simplifications. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, we just need a revolution. Everything becomes simple.
Yeah.
We'll all be happy. You know, or we just target this group of people for elimination and that will solve the problems. And so most of these, like, regimes have an extremely simplistic message. And then, you know, I think they almost, they present themselves as utopias.
Yep.
And I think the fact that they're far away, and that the people, like, here singing their praises, they're not there.
Right.
And so they're able to ignore the reality. I mean, if you want to find out the reality, it's always possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was reports coming out of the Soviet Union, even in the 30s, about what was really going on. Mm-hmm. It's easy to find out the reality of what's going on in Venezuela. So I think there's clearly a kind of desire to ignore that and choose to believe in this these alternatives. And then I think, likewise, sometimes they use them as a stick to beat their own countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like this about where I live. Oh, look over here. I'm going to use, you know, the example of this utopia to beat up on my own country. But it's a very condescending and patronizing thing to do, to ignore the reality of life in a country just for that kind of rhetorical, or even just for your own benefit of mm-hmm. feeling good about there is an alternative, we should all be like this. I mean, none of these people ever go to live in the countries they praise, which
right.
I think speaks volumes.
They will never move to Cuba or Venezuela. You know, and yeah. I want to move on because I have one more question that's not related to your book, but you brought up utopia, and I do believe that a utopian vision has to be maybe the most destructive thing a human being can have, because it always ends in the deaths of so many people. Trying to force a utopia on humanity is just evil in my mind. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's all of these guys. I mean, there's like kind of strong relation, kind of strong parallels with sort of apocalyptic religious belief, mm-hmm. you know. And it's like they believe, in most cases they've removed any sort of like sort of theology in terms of God, but there's always some instead history steps in or the race steps in, and we'll have this like apocalyptic event, and then it also divides the world into the good and evil. There are these very very simplistic things. There's the evil capitalists. Mm-hmm. The good workers. And I think as soon as you demonize like another group as an obstacle to getting to that happy place, then it becomes possible to do all kinds of things to them. And yeah. you know, and if your choice is utopia or nothing, and you really want to get to utopia, then I think it does liberate a lot of people to commit crimes they would never do otherwise. So yep. I agree. It's a dangerous force.
So my last question, and I'll let you go, is you know a lot about Russia. You live there. You're living in Texas right now. What's your take on this kind of Russian collusion, obstruction, hysteria? I would assume from being aware of your work that the idea that Russia makes mischief is not – a huge surprise, but what's your assessment?
You're correct. I think Russia, you know, Putin, he's an authoritarian. He has his own interests, mm-hmm. and he'll do whatever it takes to achieve them. Mm-hmm. And I think he also likes to make people's heads explode. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think Russia, it doesn't have the power it had when it was the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, I think it operates by other means, which is by undermining and destabilizing.
Right.
And you see this in all kind of different ways. So, you know, they move into Ukraine and take a chunk of the Crimea. And this sort of, I mean, on the one hand, it gives them access to a port, but on the other hand, it totally destabilizes that country.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always good at kind of pushing the levers and that kind of thing. And, you know, the Soviet Union was all about propaganda and agitprop and misinformation.
Yeah.
And so I think what we see today is a continuation of something that's been going on for a very long time, just in modern means. I don't think it's surprising at all mm-hmm. that Russia's making mischief and destabilizing and trying to, you know, make heads explode. But on the other hand, you know, do I think there's some overarching conspiracy, with millions of, like, chess pieces being perfectly moved around and Putin is the Grand Master. I doubt that very much. I mean, Russia's also quite a chaotic place.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think those like grandiose conspiracy theories I'm skeptical of. But the idea that Russia is like just messing with people's heads and trying to destabilize and do all kinds of things, it should be expected. It shouldn't be a surprise.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, it was great hearing from you, talking to you. Congratulations on the book, The Infernal Library. I suggest everybody listening to go check it out. And Daniel, good talking to you, man.
Thanks very much, Craig. Been a pleasure.
You got it. Take care.